So this is Current Yield, Grant's Interest Rate Observer of the Air. And I am Jim Grant, and with me as always is the great deputy editor of Grant's, Evan Lorenz. And as per always, Henry French is our sound engineer. And with us today is Paul Kupiec, who is a quite extraordinary thinker about the institution of banking. He's at American Enterprise Institute. And before I get into his CV, which is formidable, I am going to ask my sidekick, Evan Lorenz, to do a bit of dramatic reading. Paul, you see, has something to say about the banking business, and so does the FDIC. Evan, would you favor us with a dramatic reading of what the FDIC? Yeah.
Sure. This is from May 29th, and I'm speaking for FDIC Chairman Martin Grunberg. This is him summing up the first quarter results for FDIC-insured banks. The banking industry continued to show resilience in the first quarter. Net income rebounded, asset quality metrics remained generally favorable, and the industry's liquidity was stable. However, the banking industry still faces significant downside risk from the continued effects of inflation, volatility in market interest rates, and geopolitical uncertainty. In addition, deterioration in certain loan portfolios, particularly office properties and credit cards, continues to warrant monitoring.
All right. That's pretty positive, though, right?
Yeah. Earnings up, asset quality good. He didn't say stuff's going to fail. Or what is it? Subprime is contained. I mean, that was a...
Yeah. Well, before I'm going to ask Paul Kupiec of the American Enterprise Institute what he thinks about that. But first, I'm going to tell you some of his bona fides. He was chairman of the research task force of the Basel Committee on Bank Supervision. That was 2010 to 13. Associate director and later director of the Center for Financial Research at the FDIC. Deputy Chief of the Division of Banking Supervision and Regulation in the Department of Monetary and Financial Systems of the IMF, a senior analytical being at, among other institutions, Freddie Mac, J.P. Morgan, the Board of Governors of the Fed itself, and the Bank for International Settlements. He is a holder of the Ph.D. in economics from the University of Pennsylvania. Paul, what do you think of that stuff?
Thank you for inviting me and for that kind introduction. And yeah, I mean, you can never expect a government regulatory agency who's doing a report on the health of the industry they regulate to tell you it's really in bad shape. You can't expect that, can you?
No.
I thought, you know, as the earnings in the industry rebounded, in large part because the large banks did not have to, they've already paid back the insurance fund losses from the year before on First Republic and SVB Bank. And the fact they didn't have to pay it this quarter made their earnings rebound. So that was also part of his quarterly bank profile news. One of the more important things, they're not really missing it. They have told you that unrecognized interest rate losses actually increased. And I think they report something like $39 billion in the quarter ending in March. They're significant. The industry has something over $1 trillion in unrecognized interest rate losses on loans and securities and every fixed rate asset that they have, because most of these were purchased and struck back when interest rates were very low. And most of these losses are not reflected in the bank capital numbers. And so the regulatory capital numbers look pretty good. You don't find too many banks with low regulatory leverage ratios because the true value of their capital is overstated. If you actually mark their assets to market, the situation looks a lot different. That their real capital position is far weaker than the regulators would like to admit, I think.
Well, I ask you this this question, Paul, because readers of Grant's know, and as the listeners to our Current Yield will presently know, you are the author of a 61-page report, as we said in Grant's, copiously documented, the title of which is Commercial Real Estate and Bank Systemic Risk. Commercial Real Estate and Bank Systemic Risk. And the headline over our piece, quoting you and summarizing some of your findings, Paul, was the case of the fragile 27%. And to begin, would you explain to the listening audience how you came to do what you did? This long report was based on something called call reports, a very important regulatory derived information on the health or lack thereof of the banking system. and you combed through these documents, and you came up with some findings that I think will strike many people as news, and indeed for many people is also a kind of counterintuitive, the banking crisis of last year being last year's news, so it would seem. Tell us, if you please, how you did what you did and what the conclusions were.
So every quarter, banks have to fill out reports called the condition of income reports, and conditions and income reports, or call reports as they're known. And they're very extensive. There's three, depending on what kind of bank you are, there's three different versions of the call report form. And they include, there's a tailored one for small banks that it has less detail. And of course, the biggest banks have the most detail. But they file these every quarter, and there's a wealth of information in them. And from this information, you can figure lots of stuff out if you're willing to take the time and the effort. All these data are made public roughly 6 weeks after the end of every quarter. The FDIC, they're put out by the FFIEC, the Federal Institution Advisory Council. They're actually collected and processed by the FDIC. And the FDIC, shortly after the data become public, do a briefing on it, which you quoted from earlier when we first began, and that's known as the quarterly banking profile, where the chairman of the FDIC will run down the latest numbers and the headlines, and it's all at the aggregate level. But aggregate numbers, just overall numbers, sometimes hide true things that are going on inside the system. And so what I did in this paper that you mentioned is I did a bank by bank analysis of their conditions after I marked their assets to market. Now, it turns out that banks have essentially three kinds of assets and record them in different ways. They have securities that they buy, and they can hold them in two ways. They can hold them in something called an available for sale book, in which they're supposed to be recorded at market value. They can hold them in a held to maturity book, which is recorded at amortized cost or historical cost, if you want to think about it that way. And then they have loans and leases, which are held at historical cost less an allowance for expected credit losses. Tier one regulatory capital, that's the measure, that's kind of the basic measure that regulators use to determine the capital adequacy of banks. It's the kind of the base capital measure, the most solid measure in their view. That that does not include lots of unrecognized interest rate losses, and I'll explain where they come from. So in the available for sale books, only the largest, most complex banks have to include what's the gains and losses on their available for sale securities in their capital number. It's called accumulated other comprehensive income, the difference between the amortized cost and the market value of an available for sale flows into accumulated other comprehensive income, and the largest banks have to include that when they calculate their capital. So if they make money on their available for sale securities on a mark-to-market basis, that would raise their capital. If they lost money, that would lower their capital. But some time ago, back around, I don't know, it was 2015 or so, the regulators gave smaller banks the option of excluding accumulated other comprehensive income from their tier one capital measure, and something like 4,600 some odd banks chose not to include it. And that could cut either way. If interest rates were to drop and they would have big gains on their available for sale securities, then they would not be including those in their equity, in their regulatory capital number. But in the case we have right now, interest rates have increased quite a bit since they bought all their securities. So they have big losses in their accumulated other comprehensive income account, and they do not have to include that in their regulatory tier one capital calculation. So the first thing you do when you mark a bank's book to market is you've got to put back in accumulated other comprehensive income gains or losses into the regulatory capital number. That's sort of the first thing you have to do. Then you got to go to the held to maturity securities book, and banks have to report their historical amortized cost and their market value estimates of these securities. They have to report both of those in their call reports, so you can actually calculate their unrecognized interest rate loss and deduct that from Tier 1 capital, the regulatory Tier 1 capital reported. And the last category is loans and leases, which the banks in their call reports do not have to report fair market values for, only amortized costs less the allowance for credit losses. But you can calculate a rough market value estimate for fixed interest rate, long maturity securities using the numbers that banks report in their call reports. So it turns out they have to put their securities into maturity buckets. There's six different maturity buckets. They put all their marketable securities in those maturity buckets, the outstanding balance, and you've got both the historical cost for those securities and the market value of those securities. So you can calculate average discount rates across the banking system for each of those six maturity buckets. And they have to put their loans in the same six maturity buckets. So if you take the security discounts, the average security discounts, and apply them to the average loans and leases in each maturity bucket, you can come up with a rough estimate of what the market value of the loans and leases would be. And it's really kind of being a little more generous because the whole loans and leases are not as liquid or easy to sell as standardized securities that have liquid markets. And so you're really kind of downward biasing your estimate of the market value loss on the bank's books. But when you make those calculations, you can adjust bank regulatory Tier 1 leverage ratios for the unrecognized interest rate losses on their books, and you can come up with new ratios. And the new ratios look quite a bit different.
Paul, can you summarize the results from all that work with respect to Tier 1 capital?
I summarized it in a chart. So how do I explain a chart? It's a distribution.
Just hold it up to the microphone.
Hold it up. That'll work. So you just think about a distribution where you've got a histogram, a distribution where you've got a bunch of firms that look pretty well capitalized, around 10% capital. And there's a few firms that are around 6% Tier 1 leverage ratios. And then you've got a tail where there's some firms that have a lot of capital, 20%, say. Take that whole distribution and move it way to the left where you've got, I don't remember exactly off the top of my head, but 100 firms that have actually no capital or negative capital. Yeah. And you just move the whole thing to the left. And that's kind of what the banking system looks like after you make the mark-to-market adjustment. It's moving the whole thing over to the left.
So what you've done in addition to marking capital to market is to look at real estate as a percentage of the assets of the bank and as a percentage of the capital. And in a few well-chosen words, how does that look?
Well, the regulators like to monitor commercial real estate concentrations using the ratio of a bank's total commercial real estate exposure to its Tier 1 regulatory capital plus its allowance for loan and lease losses. So that's kind of the concentration ratio. So when you replace the regulatory Tier 1 capital number with the mark-to-market Tier 1 capital number, the ratios are much, much larger than the supervisory numbers that they're looking at. You know, instead of being 3, they're 7 or 8 or 9. And there's literally hundreds of banks with commercial real estate concentration ratios on a market value, loss absorbing capacity type measure that are really at risk if commercial real estate loans start defaulting in large numbers. Now, so far, the data on commercial real estate loans, most of the categories, doesn't really show this wave of defaults that a lot of people are expecting and that we see in news reports, mostly from the security side of commercial real estate lending, the loans that are done outside the banking system. But some of those are making their way into the banking system. And this measure of commercial real estate concentration after you mark the bank's capital to market, regulatory capital to market, is a much more sensible way to look at the risk that commercial real estate defaults might have for the banking system.
You focus on the risk that mark-to-market losses that banks have on their interest rate-sensitive assets and also the potential losses that commercial real estate might have on banks. And I think one of your findings was a 10% across-the-board CRE loss rate would render 628 banks holding 6.1% of all banking system assets just insolvent. Like, they would be dead. But one thing we saw last year was, now, Silicon Valley Bank wasn't a well-run bank. They got a bunch of deposits from Silicon Valley startups during, 2020 and 2021 during the everything bubble, and they invested them in the lowest-yielding securities in the history of the United States. But their demise was brought forward rapidly because as soon as people got worried, they were able to do an electronic run in the bank. A decade or two ago, if you wanted to run in the bank, you had to stand in line and actually like get your money from the bank. Now you could just open up an app and take all your money out. And it seems like you wouldn't have to realize a loss of 10% for those 628 banks to die. You would have to have a whiff of people being concerned. And then all of their depositors who are above the FDIC limit of $250,000 would just leave instantly. How does kind of this liquidity risk that's being layered on top of, very, very real solvency risks amplify or make it more risky?
This is an aspect of the issue I haven't analyzed yet. So it is what happened in Silicon Valley Bank. It was a run on the bank. So what I'm looking at in this analysis is the probability that a bank would experience a run on the bank if investors actually realize the exposure is going to be driven by this market value concentration ratio. Because if you have a market value adjusted CRE concentration ratio of 10, it only takes a 10% loss on your CRE, your commercial real estate loans, and basically you've wiped out your capital on a market value basis. There's no buffer anymore. Now the bank could continue operating as long as you point out, people keep their deposits in the bank. If they don't run and the bank's regulatory capital requirement is still above the minimum needed, the bank could keep open and operating and keep attracting insured deposits. And that effectively is what happened during the savings and loan crisis in the 80s. They kept deposit insurance in place and the regulators didn't close the banks. So the banks kept borrowing insured deposits and investing in new things and losing more money, and that could happen. So it's the exposures don't necessarily, on a market value basis, don't necessarily mean the bank will fail. The bank has a higher probability of failing if its investors who are uninsured realize the exposures, the true size of the exposures on a market value basis. They know they're not protected. The bank has no capital left in real terms, in market value terms. But it also depends on if the regulator actually makes a move and closes the bank. So if you have hundreds of banks potentially market value insolvent, there's no way the regulator is going to be able to close hundreds of banks all at once. We've seen this in many banking crises. They approach it systematically and close them as they have the resources and the staff. So it becomes then a whole confidence issue on the banking system. So if people see the weakness in the banking system and they see hundreds of problem banks and this slow motion resolution process, this doesn't engender lots of confidence, I don't think, as we learned in prior crises. So
you were the director of the Center for Financial Research at the FDIC for almost a decade. When you talk to your former colleagues about this, what do they say, like, when they're not being quoted in a press release talking about the bank's first quarter earnings? Are they concerned about this?
I haven't spoken with them directly on it, and I don't expect they would want to engage me directly on it. In general, there's famous quotes, extend and pretend. Regulators do that as well as banks. And I think one of the most famous statements at all, one of my friends and co-authors, Alex Pollock, always uses was Mr. Juncker, I think, who was the head of the European Commission or European Union, said, when things get really bad, you lie. So regulators don't always want to. Nobody's called me and said I'm wrong. And I don't think they could, actually. I think that the numbers are what the numbers are, and I'm not making it up.
Well, how long did it take you to do this exercise?
Oh, probably longer than it should have. Downloaded all the data and put it in Excel. And I had to figure out what I wanted to do and how I wanted to put the story together. So I would say it took a good 6 weeks of going blind, crunching Excel spreadsheets and trying to figure out, all the numbers I needed to calculate to put the story together and figure out, was there really a problem now, or is it an exposure problem that is yet to materialize? And so it took a while.
After Silicon Valley Bank failed, its regulator, which was the Federal Reserve, did a mea culpa report. I think it was like a 60 or 70 page report where they went over exactly how the bank failed and how the Fed, as its regulator, missed the warning signs along the way. Do you think the good people of the FDIC are aware of the problems percolating under the hood, or do you think that they're unaware, just given just like the Fed was with Silicon Valley Bank?
I think they must know. What I did in this report isn't all that high tech. I think there's plenty of good examiners that probably have made similar conclusions in their own banks and told people. And I'd be very shocked if they didn't have similar type information. The Fed, the OCC, and most of the exposures, though, are the smaller banks. So it's probably more an FDIC direct issue, not only because they're the federal regulator of the smaller banks by and large, but because they have to resolve them as well. So if you want to focus on regulatory capital and people like, I've had this discussion before with folks like Bill Seidman, who says, well, you can't mark loans to market. No, but you can't do that. You can't have bank accounting where you mark loans to market. Well, if you're the agency in charge of resolving banks, I would think you would want to know the mark-to-market value of their loans, because that's going to be a basis for what determines your loss rate if you actually have to close them. So while the regulatory numbers ignore all these unrecognized interest rate losses, you would certainly hope that the agency responsible for knowing how to resolve them and what the losses would be if they had to do it would want to do these kind of calculations. Now, did they ever do calculations like this when I worked there? No, not that I'm aware of, but we didn't have this huge increase in interest rates after near zero interest rates, for more than a decade, pretty much. We had a blip or two where rates were up, but we didn't have it, a situation like this where most of the loans were struck at really low rates. And then we had a burst of inflation that caused the Fed to have to tighten. So, we never had a situation like this. So I don't ever recall anybody ever worried about marking bank assets to market back when I was working there. But you'd think they'd know this now.
Paul, is the FDIC insurance fund at risk?
The FDIC insurance fund, has just a fraction of a percentage of, it's a little over half a percent of the value of the fund is half a percent of the assets in the banking system. And when banks fail, the loss rates on their assets are, pretty high, 20% or more. So if you had a lot of bank failures, it could run through the FDIC deposit insurance fund pretty quickly. And in fact, just two bank failures last year really hammered the deposit insurance fund. So, and they assessed the large banks for it. So if commercial real estate loans start defaulting, you know, in the ways that some people anticipate, it would be a problem for the deposit insurance fund, in my opinion.
Yeah, we talked to an investor in bank stocks, a good friend of this business. His name is Ben McAvack, and he manages a fund that owns bank stocks, mostly regional and community banks. And his response to this, as we mentioned in grants, was that loan-to-value ratios for CRE loans across the board, he thinks, are pretty conservative because away from office buildings, the kind of real estate that many of the smaller banks own, that is, industrial buildings, Chipotle's, restaurants, and strip shopping center, things that are in four-story office buildings, things that are not in the news. These properties, says Ben, have continued to appreciate, and the loan-to-value ratios on them are conservative, that the office business, he says, is confusing people about the breadth of the real estate problem. Consensus rather narrower than the headlines would suggest. Do you have any comment on that?
Yeah, I think he could be right. And one of the things I don't do in this paper is I don't predict lots of CRE loan defaults and bank failures. What I'd say is if there are CRE loan defaults in any kind of size, they're going to endanger banks. I don't have a crystal ball on CRE loans. The office loans and shopping centers, I think the exposure so far primarily at larger banks who could probably handle it. I mean, there is some evidence that non-owner occupied, non-farm, non-residential loans are the ones that are where the non-performing loan rates are rising the fastest, and they're at the bigger banks. And I think FDIC says that in their QBP, and my numbers say that. But you also have to keep in mind that I think they're closing down all kinds of these Chipotles or similar in California because they just raised the minimum wage above $20 an hour. And if we had any kind of recession at all, the oil started sucking quite a bit of air. So there, as I try to point out in the paper, commercial real estate is more than just in bank loans to commercial real estate for banks is more than just offices and shopping centers. There's all kinds of properties here. Multifamily got a lot of press, but that was focused on rent controlled buildings. I think in New York when one bank had problems with that and had to write down. So there are mitigating circumstances. So it's the regions in the country don't always behave the same way. But in any kind of banking crisis, commercial real estate is always one of the leading causes of losses. So, and right now the economy's holding up. If we were to fall into recession, other types of CRE would come under pressure. And I'm not predicting a recession. I'm not really predicting any of that. I'm just saying when you look at the true market value of capital in the banking system and in individual banks, they do not have the loss absorbing capacity that the regulatory capital numbers would lead you to believe. It's half of that's gone.
Outside of a recession, a high proportion of commercial real estate loans actually come due this year and next year. And we've actually seen real estate owners who don't offer personal guarantees with their loans, like Blackstone, actually hand back the keys to banks for not just office, but multifamily properties, and not just multifamily in New York where there's rent control, but part of the problem with multifamily was when cap rates were down like 3%, a typical owner might only put 50% equity. But now that cap rates are 5 or 6%, that equity is essentially vanished. So instead of putting good money after bad, they just hand the keys back over to the bank. So we have a high proportion of these loans coming due this year and next year. Is this a catalyst for kind of a lurch downwards? Or do banks have the wherewithal to make sure the owners don't just give them the keys and kind of shift the problem to them and extend the loans and kind of kick the can down the road?
Well, there are, troubled debt restructuring processes, and banks could restructure some of these loans, and they would, and if they continue performing, and the regulators allow them to, I would imagine you'd see some of that. On the side of defaults, most of the work I'm doing is looking at what banks' exposure is, and I don't really have a lot of information about the quality of each individual bank's properties. I'm not in a position to have that. So There is some extend and pretend evidence from the troubled debt restructured loans in some categories. It's mainly it. There's two categories. I think it was what you would think of as probably offices. I didn't see it in multifamily so much, but it could end up there. We could. I mean, there's the potential. The exposures are there, and the capital to cover it. The banks don't have a lot of the banks don't have capital to cover it. You know, there are a number of banks that are in good shape, but there's a lot of them that aren't. If these default predictions do come to pass. So
we began this segment of Current Yield, Paul, with quoting the headline, "The Case of the Fragile 27%," and the substance behind the 20 or the number behind the absolute number behind the percentage is 2,667 banks managing 27% of the banking system's total assets, including 231. I'm reading from our report on your report, 231 banks with zero or negative capital value adjusted, tier one capital is value adjusted. And that to me suggests a serious latent problem, the catalyst for which might be a recession, it might be higher interest rates, it might be an unscripted rise in inflation that does not allow the drop in funding costs that Wall Street is fairly begging for.
This brings up the debate that's been going on for a while among some people about, you know, does the Fed hold interest rates high or do they lower them because they got problems in the financial system? And this would be one of the latent problems. So you got to think the Federal Reserve is aware of these kinds of issues, at least to some degree. And certainly after I put out my paper, I would imagine they read it. If there is no let up in the inflation rate, then you've got a real problem, right? I think if they're successful and they bring inflation down and you know they can bring rates down, then some of this problem probably goes away. But I think, as you say, if they're not successful at that, we've got a problem.
Yeah. Well, Paul Kupiec, as we say here at Grants, we'll know more in 10 years.
Well, how is it? We'll wait for the data dependent analysis. We'll wait for the new data.
That's another topic. Paul Kupiec, this has been terrific, and as was the opportunity to get a look at your work a couple of weeks ago, and I felt it's a great privilege for us to be able to bring it as best we could to the readers of Grants. So thank you for that and for being with us today. And just keep on doing these things, Paul, because you have a fan base here that is just insatiable.
Well, I appreciate the kind words, and I'm glad that that you guys pick up on it and alert your investors, because people in the private sector have to do this kind of work because the regulators certainly aren't going to tell you when those.
They're busy people, Paul.
They are, Jeff.
Well, thank you, Paul Kupiec. Thank you, Evan. Thank you, Henry French. And thank you, ladies and gentlemen, most of all, for listening. This is Jim Grant on behalf of Current Yield, and talk to you soon.